Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Oh, hello. It's Thursday, and it's time to welcome you to Waypoints, where the Waypoint staff and friends take a break to nerd out and deep dive on the culture, art, and entertainment that's inspiring and provoking us lately. Gathered around the table this Thursday, we've got Patrick Klepek.
Hello.
Danielle Riandeau.
Hi, hello.
And Austin Walker.
Rob, you seem particularly provoked today.
What's very provoked.
Are you all right, buddy?
Yeah, so did you hear this? It was a really great story that came out last week.
Right,
encapsulated something.
Yeah, we're jumping into it. What's up, Rob? You look upset.
Yeah.
What if we'd recorded this podcast this morning?
I know.
Okay, fair. Yeah.
No, you found that piece early. Like you were on it. You had
not early enough that if we'd done it at like 11 a.m., I don't think.
Yeah, anyway, it could at 11 a.m.
We could have had this conversation and it could have broken in the middle of the recording.
That's correct.
Oh, we could have had a live milkshake ducking. Yeah. With the, we regret to inform you. No.
All our takes are bad.
Yeah. So the other week there was this piece from a food critic over at Thrillist, Kevin Alexander, talking about. And it's got a great title, I Found the Best Burger Place in America, and then I Killed It. And it's this sort of like...
Can I just say that every time I read that thing, I go in my head, and then I freaked it. Because, anyway, because we're good. We're good. We can continue.
Good.
So the story he's telling is basically he went on a national, like, what's the best burger in all of the United States, and he goes to all sorts of burger joints and mom and pops, and he finds the greatest burger at this tiny, humble little diner in Portland, Oregon.
Yeah.
And he names it as the best burger in America, and like within 6 months, the place is shut down. It's closed. Yeah. And the story this guy tells is like popularity did this place in. Like they could not stand the scrutiny and the popularity that came with being named Thrillist's greatest burger joint in America.
Rob, when you put it that way, you're starting to undercut it even now.
Yeah, I mean, well, obviously there was a bit of self-importance in that framing, right? It was a little bit of a navel-gazing piece. Now, here's the other thing, though. Thrillist lists are pretty fucking good, not going to lie. Mm-hmm. Like there's a lot of like sites that do these lists. Thrillists tend to be pretty solid.
And that was
kind
of what he was saying, too, was that like one of the things that I think made this story so attractive before we even get into the meat of it is that the frame of it was like media elite bait. For people who work in the media industry, it was speaking to shit we've dealt with over the last decade, the rise of the algorithm, the period of time by which you could game Facebook by doing lists and listicles. And what he was saying was like, I want to do it. I decided I wanted to do it the right way. It's easy to do top 10 fast food burgers because that's just bullshit that you knock out in an afternoon. What if I could get Thrillist to pay me to go around the country and actually try all the burgers and then eat them and then make a real ass rating?
And
he did the math. He did the math. He showed his work.
There's a little bit as I read that that I was like, all right, that's what every fucking journalist says. Like, if you just gave me the time and go to the authentic thing, I'm going to get you the real story. It'll also do real good traffic.
It'll do
real
well.
You know what the reality is? Most of the time, it doesn't do very good traffic, and you actually should have just done the cynical thing.
Patrick, everybody should go read Patrick's article, One Designer's 15-Year Journey to Ship the Doom Mod he started as a teen.
Not the point I was
Are
thinking
you sure?
I am sure, actually.
You want me to read from the Discord? You know, yeah. Anyway, you should continue.
Convenient, but not actually. But you got me. Not what I was trying to do, but you got me anyway. It still fits. The shoe is still on my foot.
It's on there.
So the thing is, the version of the story, he has already reached his conclusion before he begins researching this follow-up story, right? That's the other thing, is he understands that, like, after he gave that rating and after he gave that ranking, that place went under fast. And he comes back to it with the conclusion that, like, on some level, what I did sank this place. And he comes back and revisits the story, and it's a meditation on, and I still think there's a lot that is worthwhile in this piece about what it's reflecting on and what these sort of rankings, these neighborhood guides, what they're all trying to speak to and what they're trying to accomplish. And yet, his central character here is the guy who runs this diner. What is his name? Ray Stanich?
Steve Stanich. Got that good alliteration.
Yep.
Yeah, so Steve Stanich. And he links back up with the guy, and he asks, so what happened? And he's told the story of, like, how the popularity crushed the place. It wasn't equipped to handle it. It couldn't scale. And it was just too stressful. And there's a subtext of, there's some other shit going on with this guy. The way the interview with him is described is a little uncomfortable. Like, it sounds like this is a guy who's going through some stuff. But fundamentally, nothing in the piece makes you think that, like, anything else happened here other than, you know, tiny neighborhood joint gets national attention, becomes a destination for tourists, and completely shatters under the pressure. This morning,
here we go.
A piece was published at the Willamette Gazette, that looks into the background of the story, and there's actually a way uglier and less poetical, but also much more conventional story that happened here, which is that this is a family business, and Steve Stanich has basically destroyed his relationship with his family because he was arrested for strangling his wife in front of their son.
Yeah.
And yeah. In front of their son.
Stage 4 breast cancer at the time as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not to death, but I'm not, this is not a defense of Steve Stanich, to be clear.
No.
But I just wanted to clarify. Yes. It was not a murder. That was
not a murder, but an assault.
Which would have been a whole other, an assault, a domestic assault.
Yes.
Of a terrible sort. To someone who is
very ill.
Very, very ill, all of which is just contributing to something that's already terrible.
Yeah.
And then in the wake of that, so naturally there's been a divorce, and Steve Stanich is also kind of reneging on a lot of the commitments he made during those divorce proceedings, as well as he apparently is now also in a lot of legal trouble due to various driving under the influence, charges that have been levied against him. So
the story in question, people, it's from the Willamette Week. It's, did a rave review really shut down Portland Burger Bar Stanich's? ? Maybe it was the owner's legal troubles. Which is such a side-eye.
Which are extensive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And so this all came out this morning, and Patrick spotted it quickly, which I'm very glad he did, because otherwise we would have recorded like 30 minutes on, this good, humble American restaurateur.
What a funny guy.
Just living his life.
In retrospect, though, that paragraph in the story, I stared at it for a while.
Same.
I don't have the story up in front of me. Does someone have the
I got
piece?
It.
And can you just read that paragraph?
Yeah, totally. So he's setting up. He says, this, the closing of the restaurant, I tell him, actually sounds like it was my fault. I put a target on their back by naming them number one, blah, blah, blah. Stanich says, no, successful people don't blame others. And then in a quieter voice, he started to explain why it wasn't just 2 weeks, why the restaurant hadn't just closed for 2 weeks. He asked me not to reveal the details of that story, but I can say that there were personal problems, the type of serious things that can happen with any family and would have happened regardless of how crowded Stanich's was, and that real life is always more complicated and messier than we want it to be. And that stuff was happening in the background on top of ongoing.
It's a good rhetorical flourish, but there's, in especially in retrospect, not enough.
Yeah,
like real talk on like if you're, I mean, obviously, like I do all sorts of reporting, and I have like concealed and not concealed, but like not published certain information based on the request of a source. Maybe you're, you know, protecting their employment, you know, for whatever. There's all sorts of reasons that you don't do that. But then when you go to the degree of disclosing, like usually you don't disclose that you're not publishing information. You just don't publish it because of reasons. Right. The point when you do that, increasingly, especially in retrospect, there's not enough. That doesn't pass muster. Like I looked at that as a reporter and like held my tongue thinking, like the word serious is I'm getting stuck on that word. Now, it was just to say the writer who has not really responded, because all this is probably happening very fast, they gave a quote to the original paper that found or summarized these allegations, and the author claimed that what he was told is not the information that's coming out. If I had to take a wild guess, it's somewhere in between.
Yeah. That's
exactly what I was going to say. That like every time, and I've certainly known plenty of people who sound a lot like Stephen here, it'll be, I had a fight with my wife. You know how it is with the kids and the wife and the divorce. And you know, I can just hear the bluster because this guy blusters. It sounds like, you know, there's a passage where a woman comes in, just a local comes in, and she's like, when are you going to open up? And apparently he times it, the writer times it, that it's 6 minutes of this and that and, like, blustering about this and talking about that and blah, 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 before he's finally like, thanks for your business or whatever. And she's like, oh, okay, I'll come back. It's 100%. I can imagine him saying, I had a fight with my wife, you know, didn't look good, you know, but he didn't. I would bet $1,000 he didn't say, well, I have these assault charges.
But I mean, if you say like, hey, I'm dealing with some like drinking issues and my wife and I split up.
Right.
I could easily imagine. I'd be like, whoa, okay.
Yeah.
I'm not going
to. What does that have to do with this? What does that seemingly have to do with this story? Right.
Yeah.
Right. And you dig deeper there, right? That's the thing.
That's when you look it up.
That the irony here is that this is a piece that the heart of it, the reason it was passed around so much was partially the framing around algorithmic, you know, increases in story readership, but also because it was about journalistic ethics. And the question that as people who cover culture and who cover the world, what is the effect of our coverage? It's a question we've asked ourselves a lot this year, both in positive and negative times, right? Like we say, okay, could have we handled this differently? Or, hey, do we have a responsibility to talk about this very difficult thing because we know what the outcome will be if we're quiet about it? And then this happens, and it's like it falls in on itself because there's this other type of journalistic integrity and responsibility, which is to check your fucking facts and to like make sure you're reporting out all the sides of the story, even when it costs you more legwork, even when it could undercut the very sweet and clean version of the story you were hoping to be able to tell.
Because if you, as a seen with a reporter's perspective, there's an even like there's a stronger version of this story with all of this information, in which like if again from like the like journalistic meta perspective is that like often you go into a story with preconceived notions, with a narrative, because you can't just go into a story with no sense of where it's going. The facts may take you elsewhere, the story may take you elsewhere, but usually you go in with some sort of frame, and then you see how the details fall within that frame and you massage as you get there. Like there's a very compelling piece in which like, well, halfway through it's like, well, that's the story I thought I was writing.
Yeah.
But like, this is what I actually found out about this person. And here's what complicates like this, like sweet narrative that I, you know, had gotten us from A to B, but where we actually arrive at C is something far different, muddier, uglier.
Yeah. So it ends up being it's frustrating because I think what is interesting here, and this is why it was, you know, too good a story to fully vet, is that it was such a perfect illustration of something that I think a lot of people have observed anecdotally or feel is happening on some level with particularly like cultural criticism, like, you know, being a culture editor of a city newspaper or being a food critic, anyone who is sort of, you know, reviewing, rating, ranking, taste making for a community and directing audiences directing audiences to places with an eye toward finding ever more authentic underground, local places. And this story was kind of a perfect exemplar of that. Like, you could not, like, the version of Steve Stanish that this guy had bought into and Stanish's restaurant was like the ideal, like, you know, you can almost see that diner in your mind's eye, what it was like stepping into it. And you can imagine how a place like that would sink like a stone under a crush of the sort of people who do sort of who always make a point to visit the top ranked places, right? To, you know, take the photo of, you know, the food you're being served at a trendy joint. But that just proves not to be the story here. And so it's a much more conventional story of, it's a family business and some awful things happen within that family. And, you know, the guy running the business turns out to be an abuser and, you know, wipes out.
Responsible for his own problems.
Yeah.
As it turns out.
So, and that's why I would have preferred just to talk about The Raid.
Never seen – that is in my top 10 that every, like, 6 months or so I tell myself, why haven't I seen
that? Yeah, watch The Raid, dude.
Okay.
So yeah, it's on Netflix. It's The Raid Redemption.
We're watching The Raid. We're playing The Order.
Okay.
Yeah. That's been decided.
We're making a list today.
Yep.
Jesus.
I think they're going to hear this one first.
Probably hear this before we do the Raid cast.
Don't worry about it. Yeah.
Yeah.
God. Whew. Do you have anything else on Stanich's, or are we able to eject here? And
is that what they call their burgers, Stanich's?
Yeah.
I think we should give him a knuckle Stanich, which ties into our next waypoint.
Oh, wow.
Did you like
I
that?
Didn't expect the seg there.
You know.
What's our next waypoint? Right. What is our next waypoint?
Well, it's Rob's job. I just was so excited to have that, you know. Sorry, Rob.
Well, no, take it
Continue.
Away.
Continue. All right, let's give him a knuckle sandwich, as in what you do in the beautiful, wonderful, great sport of mixed martial arts, which is my waypoint this week. Let me get the title of it, because I was so excited to get that joke right, and then I don't have the title.
It is a series over on SB Nation called Fighting in the Age of Loneliness.
Correct. Yes. A five-part or a six-part documentary series. Five-part documentary series. We've seen the first two for Waypoints today. I'm not sure if the third one is up yet as of recording. But it goes into the history and the politics of MMA, of specifically of the UFC, but also mixed martial arts as a sport in general, and its rise to prominence. It's very sort of weird rise to prominence because it is a very weird sport. So it actually starts in on some good old Ronald Reagan, and goes through the bluster of several sort of modern era presidents, ties very directly into sort of the economics and politics of the times. Talking about the 80s and then the early 90s, the UFC started in 1993. So it's a bunch of stuff that kind of coincides with that. The first episode starts in on these sort of grand notions about the presidents of the U.S., about Reagan and what Reaganomics kind of did to our country. Goes into things like the Gulf War, the Clinton era, et cetera. And then ties that into the Anderson Silva-Chris Weidman fights in July of 2013, which is considered to be, at least the thesis here is that it's considered to be sort of the beginning of this era, the sort of mega popular superstardom era of MMA and the UFC, which was a major fight. It was a really, really gross fight. It was from a little bit before my time as a mega fan. Mm-hmm. And I suppose I should set this up as a person who trains in MMA, who competes in at least the grappling half of MMA, and loves it and loves the sport, despite a lot of problematic elements, which we'll go into.
Yeah, this is sort of like – this whole piece feels like a love letter to your problematic fave.
Yes.
But then parentheses, but not for the reasons you think it's problematic.
100%.
Right?
Yeah. That is crystallizes exactly how I feel about the sport, especially the UFC, which I have more problems with than, you know, smaller – fighting conventions and so on and so forth. But yeah, and it goes into the history. So we're looking at the politics of the era. We're looking at this particular fight in 2013, and then it goes into the actual history of mixed martial arts, which begins as sort of the fighting arts, the sort of open hand fighting arts of the samurai, which, of course, like many things, was like part of a privileged class, something that only the samurai families knew and were taught in. And then, of course, it kind of filters down. I'm going really quickly here through this stuff, but it goes down, and the Gracie family in Brazil sort of take a lot of the judo and jiu-jitsu, which are the two specific arts that are sort of framed here as the main things, and also vale tudo a little bit, and a few other things. But the general thing here being a lot of these sort of grappling arts and open hand arts, no weapons. And how the Gracie family are basically Brazilian jiu-jitsu royalty, which they absolutely are. There's a Henzo Gracie Academy a mile from here. Mm. It's one of the best schools in America. And how that kind of fed into this era of the UFC and of, oh, this, we can make money doing this. We can actually make a ton of money doing this. People are going to watch this. People are going to buy tickets for this. Holy shit. So this weird martial art with all this bizarre history and a lot of multiple eras of class history as well feed into, oh my God, this sport can make tons of fucking money and be such a huge big thing. Rob, I know you're.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting series. Like, it's like a video lecture on the history of MMA, and it's trying to both get at what is at the heart of MMA and then what is at the heart of our culture's growing obsession and fascination with MMA. And I think it's a very uneven series, I have to say. Like, I think its gestures toward cultural critique aren't that convincing, at least to me. Like, it feels very much like Chapo B-roll in some ways.
You should actually start up.
I should have said who actually made it.
Oh, yeah. Let's please.
Go for it.
Watching this felt like a giant troll, honestly. I got like 5 minutes into this when I was like, was this just a giant conspiracy to make me listen to fucking Chapo Trap House all over again?
Why did you ever stop? Well, I know why, but nevertheless, no, I mean, so our narrator, our investigator, our guide for this is Felix Biederman, who many of you may be familiar with from the Chapo Trap House.
All the gray wolves out there are already howling.
Howling,
Felix's name.
Howling again.
And it's John Boyce. We should also say John Boyce is the director and producer of the piece. So yes. It has his flourishes, his style of like –
it feels like a Pretty Good if you've ever watched
Yeah, if you
one
watched a Pretty Good, it feels like a long-form Pretty Good.
Yeah.
Pretty Good is the series by John Boyce. People should look into that.
And it
uses some aesthetics that he's used in previous multimedia presentation. Because John Boyce, great writer, but also like one of the things that made a lot of his work exciting was that he's also starting to push against the boundaries of like what does content on the web look like. At this point now, apparently it looks like a YouTube video. But nevertheless.
Longer though than
correct.
Most. You know?
Well, look, CMSs are hard. Making them do cool things is hard.
Yeah.
That's
YouTube,
true.
Though. YouTube. Anyway... So I think the things that I find most compelling is like Biederman clearly knows his shit about fighting history and mixed martial arts history, and like his excitement and interest and passion for the evolutionary movements within this field and where they sort of come from and who the major players are is palpable. And it gave me so much more context for stuff that I'm familiar with from my days of watching like the Ultimate Fighter reality show, but that it was never really like parsable to me. And also I think he's got kind of a fascination for the fight game in particular and in all its incarnations. And I fold wrestling under this as well for the purposes of this. I would say like it's always attracted kind of a mix of like skilled, you know, craftsmen, charlatans, suits, and obsessives. And he sort of, I think, has a great deal of interest and affection for those kinds of scenes, even as he sees how they can sort of lay the groundwork for a lot of rot, at the heart of something.
Yeah, I think it, you know, from the first episode is called The Invention of Fighting for Money. The second is the unwashed masses clamor for weird men brutalizing each other. And the third is the Yakuza find something to do with their money. And so there is a through line here that is often about class struggle or about the ways in which combat sports are often attractive to working class folks, to oppressed folks, to people who want to literally want and need to know how to fight, but often are those people are preyed on or put in the ring or are kind of monetized by those who are rich, either through the monopoly over combat sport technique and the ownership of training methods, or through the operation I keep wanting to say publications, and that's super wrong. Promotions,
yeah.
And connections to established legal figures or government figures, political figures, who can clear the way to allow for these fights to happen legally and for a lot of money. I think that stuff mostly works for me because it's so clearly rooted in history that he understands. And some of the stuff around the Brazilian scene and the different kind of the conflicting styles of combat sport at the time, really fascinating. The stuff that ends up being really interesting to me, but I don't know where I come down on it yet, and my hope is by the fifth episode I'll have a better understanding, is some of the stuff that's happening here with questions of identity, with questions of what combat sports are for and who they're for, both in terms of practitioners and in terms of spectators. Like the two things that come to mind here, and I know you have some notes on this, Danielle. The first is this relationship between identity and the body. There's this whole section in which he's talking about Kano Jigoro, who is this guy who wanted to be in combat sports. He wanted to be in jiu-jitsu, and he was 5'2 and 90 pounds, mm-hmm. and surrounded by big tough guys. And there's this quote that Felix uses, which is that that Jigoro wanted to, quote, use martial arts as a fulcrum against those parts of oneself that make them feel as though they did not belong. And that continues throughout the piece, this idea that fighting sports and martial arts are ways of building the self, and ways of kind of mushing on yourself until you find something in there that is you that can go wherever it wants, both in terms of like I can walk down the street at night and kick anybody's ass who comes at me, or in terms of I can look in the mirror and what I see is me and I'm happy with that. And I think that's already very like powerful and potent and difficult material. There's a reason why I suspect this series is called Fighting in the Age of Loneliness. But also there's this other turn in that second episode that ends up being about spectatorship but still about identity, which is that Felix positions the rise of MMA – and this isn't, I think, a unique thing. Danielle, you can speak
to this. It's not unique. Yeah.
That the rise of MMA is a response to the rise of 90s political correctness, that it is the popularity, its growth is a response to identity politics, to what Felix calls HR culture, contrasting it to PC culture. And there's a quote there in which he says that, you know, he sees it as a response to, quote, 90s professionalism and bloodlessness, and says that, quote, the main point of PC culture was not to protect the individual but the company. We never really stopped doing things because we cared about the feelings of others. We did them because we'd be shoved out the window with no net to catch us. And this is for me like – I've listened to Chapo, like obviously you know who the fuck I am, yeah. But also one of my consistent critiques of Chapo is that they often will default to this unspoken we. Who is the we in the sentence? Yeah. We will be shoved out the window with no net to catch us if you do something not PC, if you follow the new rules of HR in the 90s, who if you are compelled to go seek out blood sport, quote unquote, to John McCain, right, in order to find some release and connection to some machismo deep inside is how Felix is kind of positioning it. And the thing that's the tension there for me is on one hand, he's talking about martial arts and combat sports as a way to create identity from a non-privileged position, but then he slips constantly into the privileged spectator position without questioning it. And I'm hoping that that tension resolved by the end of the series.
Yeah, so much of that for me, I completely agree. That was the biggest sore point for me. And also just positioning this as, well, this is what working class white bros do. This is what they're into. And it's like, I'm sure some are. You know, I know plenty of MMA fans who don't fit into that. And I know plenty who do. But frankly, it has been a sport that, okay, there's a lot of problems with it. There are a million problems with it. But for myself and for a lot of the women and the queer people and non-binary and trans people that I train with or that, you know, I know, and I can cite a couple pieces here that have been really instructive, I think. It's so empowering. And it's so empowering for so many people who are not in that group, right. Who are not just like, well, I'm so mad at women. But I can't say anything because I'll get thrown out of the office. Like, it's not, you know what
so
I mean?
So here's
like
my $19.99 for the pay-per-view.
You're right. Like, right, I can, right. I understand where that thought process might be coming from, and I understand that that might be true of a chunk of the audience, but I begged to differ, you know, certainly during that portion of this. And I also, I really hope they go into women in MMA, and mm-hmm. I really hope they go into, and I assume that they will, obviously. There's a picture of our girl, Angela Hill,
right.
in the first, among the first pictures of MMA. So it's like, all right, cool. Which, mm-hmm. by the way, she was subject of a Waypoint documentary.
That's true. Out.
Yeah, exactly. She's great, and she's awesome. but the ways in which this sport, again, with all its problems, and it has many, the ways in which this sport, men and women, women can actually be headliners in this sport. Women are not treated like in the WNBA, like a sideshow mm-hmm. to the main sport. Women could be the headliner. They can be the biggest moneymaker. They can be awesome. They can be rad. And as much as there's plenty of sexism and machismo in this sport, at the very least, women could actually be on the poster. And not as a ring girl, as right. the fighter. People are talked about as fighters. There is clearly still some sexism, especially from the, you know, the kind of like the more meathead commentators and so on and so forth. But for the most part, people talk about the techniques that they're doing. They're not talking about their ass and their shorts or right, whatever. Right. It's like, oh, yeah, she did that. She did this. She did this. So it is absolutely a sport that is coming of age at a later time than most other sports where the women's version of the sport is crucially different in some ways. The rules are different in women's lacrosse versus men's lacrosse. The ball is a different size in women's versus men's. It's actually treated with some decency. And there are queer women who are in this sport, open and out, and they have been open and out since the very first day women were competing in the UFC. Liz Carmouche was actually, okay, it was UFC 157. It was the first UFC fight where their women competed. It was Ronda Rousey versus Liz Carmouche. Liz Carmouche has been out the whole time, and nobody hid that fact. Mm-hmm. There was a major headline fight last May that had two queer women. They were the poster. This is the title fight. And in the sort of the packages that went out before that showed both of them with their girlfriends or fiancés. I think they're both – whatever. The couples are all together mm-hmm. and like holding hands and being cute and actually being openly queer. And this is on the UFC's own material. This is not like, oh, their Instagram. Right. It's like they're out and they're queer and they're people of color and it's fucking awesome. So part of me is – always going to have that tension with this sport and feel like, oh my God, this is one of the first places where a major, massive sport has women who can make as much money as the men and be super fucking queer. On the other hand, I'm sure being a gay dude in MMA is ridiculously hard. I obviously know some because that's yeah. folks who I train with. I train with a queer grappling group, but it's not easy for a lot of people.
There's a second thing here that I'm curious about your take on as someone who I know what your politics are, but I also yeah. know your love of MMA. And the same for Rob and Patrick as sports fans. One of the things Felix slips into here and there throughout this piece is there's a bit where he's talking about Helio Gracie.
Yes.
And Helio Gracie is one of the huge Gracie clan, this group of yes. Brazilian MMA aficionados and entrepreneurs,
royalty
like you said, who was sort of like one of the sport's early or kind of jiu-jitsu's early proponents and defenders and like great like champions of the sport, not in the sense that he was a successful winner, but in the sense that he was championing the sport and would take all comers to prove the strength of Brazilian jiu-jitsu. And there are moments in describing Helio Gracie in which Felix says familiar phrases, things like, he put in the kind of hours necessary to win. He had a superhuman effort. Like, yes, others may have won here or there more, but he was willing to get maimed badly for it. And there is a framing of him in this way that is this liberal individual hero. Put in the hours. Work late. Like, keep going. Keep hustling and you'll win. And that's all over sports. Like, that's not the yeah. team that wants it most wins. The team that stays, you know, are we talking about practice? We're talking about the game. We're talking about practice. Like, that whole conversation around Allen Iverson was about not putting in the work necessary to win, because core to so many of our sports stories is this idea of the liberal agent who, if they train hard enough, they can win. When in reality, we know every team trains really hard, and there's only one winner at the end of the year. And I'm curious.
Or God intervened.
Or God intervened. You know,
the act of God.
Yeah, act of God.
God decided you had to win today.
Yeah, that's fair. You're right. That's the other one. We do get that a lot. Totally.
A lot.
But I'm curious because, like, Felix is so Felix, right? We know what Chapo is. We know that these are people who are hypercritical of the production of the individual, the production of the liberal subject, who the kind of mythologizing of the, if you work hard enough, you can be the best. But even here, he slips into it.
This is even more, if I may, as somebody who obsesses over Brazilian jiu-jitsu and trains it every day, it's even more extreme in BJJ, for sure, because every single school will tell you, like, this is the art where the smaller, weaker person can absolutely tear the shit out of a much bigger, much stronger, much more athletic person. Right. You see the evidence of it. Like, I have a friend who is a purple belt who is 4'11", 95 pounds. She's tiny. And she could throw the guys who are 250 pounds. No fucking problem. Every day. And it's like, this is real shit.
Yeah. I wonder if that's where this goes. It's like, is part of the attraction to MMA and to jiu-jitsu that
– especially the grappling portion. The striking is very –
Your arms are this long, you're gonna get hit. If you're gonna fucking watch this, there is a moment when there is a moment in that first episode that is brutal to watch.
Go in
knowing that there is a kick.
The Silva injury?
The Silva injury is just, if you can't look at that stuff.
It is a broken leg.
If you were on Twitter that year, you saw it though.
You saw
Trust
it.
Me.
Like, I did not see it. I missed that because I know.
Yeah, I had not seen it either.
I know what my limits are.
Jello. Yeah.
It's Jello.
Jello.
It's unbelievable. Be careful.
Yes.
But for it's part of the attraction to MMA for people that, like, we live in this world in which so much is preconditioned and where the boundaries and limits are already preconceived, and privilege is such a factor that the promise of a space where, tall or short, you know, whatever your weight class is, you can compete if you know the right throws and you can execute on them, if you can read your opponent. Here finally is the invisible hand. That's my favorite technique. Or here finally is the kind of almost Rawlsian space without pretext. Here is the space where the market functions properly. And the market in this case is like takedowns.
The main thing being – and to get at this even closer, the main thing being – if you're a human being, this won't work against robots, right?
Right.
But if you're a human being, you have a lot of, you can be choked easily. Anybody, the biggest, thickest neck in the world, your carotid arteries are right here. Mm. Your joints are – so a lot of this was developed with, like, okay, what's weak on everybody? You have the biggest fucking dude, break his arm like that. It just – if you go the wrong way. So I think there is, like, such an attraction to this. However, that line, that sort of tagline of, like, the smaller, weaker opponent can absolutely trash a much bigger opponent – also means you're going to need 10 more years of training versus any, you know what I mean? Like,
and training is expensive.
It's expensive as hell. It is not cheap. I will not go on to tell you how much I spend on MMA training per month. It's a lot. But yeah, it's expensive. And it is like the further up you go, the harder it gets, obviously. It is really, really difficult to go from purple to brown to black. Like at my level, it's, you know, whatever. You're just kind of figuring things out. But it is physically true that the smaller, weaker opponent can absolutely trash the shit out of a much stronger, much bigger opponent. However, there's a lot of other things that go into that amount of training to make it that difference. So excited. We're talking about jiu-jitsu.
I thought I saw a hand from Rob a moment ago.
Yeah, I mean, I think two things sort of like live side by side here. On the one hand, what you put in, the work you put in, the hours you sink in, the effort, like that stuff does matter. That stuff does pay back. Like you know, you train hard so you can perform on game day, stuff like that. And yes, there's gonna, like, both sides are trying to win. That's why it's a competition. But I think sports, what is one of the things that's alluring about sports is it at least promises on some level to be the place where the laws of the meritocracy are not self-serving bullshit, at least for, you know, for one game, for one match, for one bout. That's, you know, that's going to hold true. But I think what this series does a pretty good job of saying up front is this family is basically royalty. This guy brought in like this guy's family worked closely with one of the greatest martial artists in, like post, in Meiji Japan,
right? Yeah,
To work with them and teach them, and so I think implicit in everything this guy accomplished and what Elio accomplished is this idea of this is a rich aristocrat mm-hmm. who made it his life's work to throw a big dude because he was a little guy and he didn't like it, and he spent a fucking fortune so that he could be the best at it, and he accomplished great things, you know, in that. But I don't think it erases the fact that, like, he founds this school of martial arts to teach his family and people like them the skill set that they prized very highly. And when they had competition from across town from a neighborhood they didn't like, they fucking rioted.
Yeah,
And so I think
a whole episode on just that fucking thing. There's what's it called? It's called the like
The Vale Tudo.
There's like the Vale Tudo, like the it's like the something arena.
Oh, the Naga.
Yeah.
I think it's Naga.
I don't remember what it's called. I looked it up last night, but like about these two, the royal family of jiu-jitsu and like the like low down and dirty street fighting. Fighting is probably not fair, but whatever it is in Brazil, literally
it translates to like anything goes. So it's not too far.
Okay.
Yeah, I think Vale Tudo actually means like no rules or few rules or something.
The Gracies like literally march through the streets to their rival gym and just
It's a long march.
It's like a long march. It's wild. And then there's just like a throwdown. I want to dock just on that.
That's a great story, but
also when it's the guys from the rich man's dojo fucking descending on another part of town, that also doesn't just sound like a fight between two doctrinal schools of martial arts.
No,
there's a lot of other stuff that's happening there. And so I think, you know, I think in the way this series frames it, I think as a fight aficionado, as an enthusiast, you know, Biederman, I think, does buy into and admires the craft and the skill and the work that goes into it. But I think in the way he frames everything, he's never really blind to the class relationships and the opportunities people get to get them to this point.
We are just as guilty in a weird way, right? Which is like I was going to say any Red Dead coverage, but that's not true. Look at our Red Dead coverage, which is – and Kotaku's, which is like, hey, there is a labor practice here that's fucked. But also – because we know what the work looks like, there are times at which we need to and feel compelled to say, and also these people worked fucking hard. These people put in long hours to do something incredible and blah, 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 blah. So I am as a hypocrite. If I was like, and fuck Felix for this, I would be a huge hypocrite. Because like this does happen when you're this close to a thing is you can see the structural dilemmas. You can see the systemic injustice and also be compelled by the craftsmanship, by the work put in by the people who do the work. And you want to like celebrate that, even though it often is tied up in with this really – this tumorous like organizational structure.
Completely. And there are fighters who are working to get a union going. Leslie Smith is one of the most –
Are they not unionized? They're another group that's – okay.
Oh, God.
That sucks.
It's awful. I mean, we can talk all day about labor practices in UFC. It's atrocious and terrible. But Leslie Smith, you can follow her on Twitter. She is working hard to do a unionization effort. She got cut from the roster for being vocal about – sorry, journalistic intent. I don't know that this is directly what caused it. I can say as a cultural critic that I suspect that is what caused it. Mm-hmm. But she's a fighter who has been working towards unionization. And there is one part of me that, of course, in the spirit of all of this, in the spirit of loving the game and not necessarily the structure around it, there are a lot of amazing – and, of course, I'm going to frame this for as a queer person who does this in New York City. There are other cities that do have things like collectives that have like donation-based training, very, very cheap training or completely free training, especially for queer folks, especially for maybe gender nonconforming folks. There's a piece that went up today in them.us called Fighting Notions of Toxic Masculinity in a Trans-Inclusive MMA Class. There are organizations that are fighting to – make MMA the most inclusive, rad thing in the world. There's a place called Trans Boxing here in New York City. There's several other organizations. So I want to shout those out because those folks are doing the work to make this really inclusive and really awesome and to show folks the good and the empowering part of this versus obviously the where the money goes.
Right.
And lastly, the second episode ends on this like horrific note with fucking Dana White, president of the UFC, endorsing Trump at the Republican, I can't even say it. That's how upset I am. Republican, you know, Republican National Convention. And I will say, if you want to be as pissed at the Gracies as we are at Dana White, they gave an honorary black belt to the new president of Brazil, the fascist.
Awful. Good.
So that happened recently.
Great. Good.
So I don't know, man. Just if you believe in the beauty of this sport and the beauty of how it can actually be an equalizer, support those organizations doing awesome work at the ground level.
All right. And we will take a quick break here, and then we will be back with big Wobots doing big steppies.
Great. Good.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
So, Austin.
Hey, hi. Austin Walker here.
It seems like there's been some news on the mecha front and the anime front. Would you care to catch us up and set up this week's waypoint?
I need you to know I looked for a beer before I came back. We took a break. I went to the bathroom and I went to look for beer. But there's no beer. There was a guy pouring wine and I thought about it. But he seemed like he wanted to talk to me and sell me the wine. I don't know why there's
a
wine salesman.
Did you try the second floor?
I didn't try the second floor. Is there beer on the second floor?
We always have beer.
Is that guy having trouble with
there? We always have beer and cups.
Maybe he's a Cowboy Bebop fan.
He could be. That's the real.
Dealing with today's news.
Okay, so Netflix gave us the anime, the nation of anime lovers, the otaku of the world, 1-2 punch this week. I'll tell you the second punch first, which is they announced a Cowboy Bebop live action show, which, listen, I'm not who I used to be. I'm fine. Fucking make your stupid live action show. It's fine. It's not going to be good. It's going to be bad and I'm going to watch it and it's fine. I'm not – Cowboy Bebop's a great show, but it's more of a good show than a great show. It's in my top five anime of all time list.
Hold on.
Mostly a good show.
Okay. All right.
What?
What?
You said it's mostly a good show, not a great show?
But it's also in my top five of all time.
I feel
formative,
complicated.
It was a formative show?
It's a deeply formative show. Right. And I think
it's the difference between like your favorite show and the best show, right? Like we try and like separate those two?
I may have once given a talk about how there is no such thing as the difference between those two things. And so I'm very complicated feelings about it. We'll talk about Cowboy Bebop another day.
Okay.
We'll talk about that another day. Uh-huh. That's a different thing.
Uh-huh.
Today,
but things that aren't complicated or ambiguous.
Let me tell you about Shinsekai Evangelion, a.k.a. Neon Genesis Evangelion, a.k.a. What is the actual name? It means like Shinsekai is the gospel of a new century.
Good.
The gospel of the new century is what the name of the show means. Netflix announced earlier this week that they are bringing Evangelion, a.k.a. Eva, to Netflix in the spring, kind of like an HD, not even a remaster, just they're bringing it to the streaming service, including some of the
it's
movies.
It's not a remake, it's the
show
itself.
It's not a remake, it's the show itself. It's not a live version of the show, it is the show itself. Eva is a cult classic, a critical success. One of the most important shows in contemporary anime history. If you're telling the story of anime, you tell the story of Eva, at least in brief. If you're telling a story about mecha anime, you stay there for a little bit. It is a show – so if people don't know anything about the show, if you've never heard of what Evangelion is, it is a show about the very high level. In fact, there's a very funny thing to do, which is if you just do a Google search for Evangelion, Google gives its synopsis, and it says, teens fight alien war machines, animated. And that's it.
That's
not wrong.
It's not wrong. It's not wrong. It is a show about the invasion, a sort of existential threat to the world by these strange beings called angels, and it follows a character named Shinji Ikari, who is brought in to a group paid for by the UN, who is building robots to fight these strange invaders. On its face, it's very similar to a lot of other mecha shows. And in fact, that's not only intentional, that is kind of one of the points of the show. And in fact, reflects the creator's history. The lead creator, the director of the show, someone named – I always forget his first name. I know his last name is Anno. Hideaki Anno. And he is someone who had made anime shows for years. He did a show that's pretty good called Gunbuster, which is another mecha anime show about fighting aliens.
All right.
He'd done an animated movie for Gainax called Space Force. And then he fell into a serious depression. And he spent years not finishing anything, making stuff that didn't ever come to fruition. And then one day he was out drinking with a buddy from King Records, a record company, and the guy from King Records said, hey, you should make – we'll get you a TV slot. Like, we'll pay you to make something, make anything, and we'll pay you, because this is how it works. Like, this part of – one of the ways anime gets made, especially anime shows, is that they are not just paid for by, like, a TV production company. They're paid for by a production committee that is co-owned by various corporate interests.
Okay.
This is how, like, you know – we'll talk about Gundam a little bit, but like Gundam gets made partially through studio money, but also by the companies that own the video game rights and that own the toy rights and the model rights, because they are pitching in for the production so that they will then get all of the royalties from that merchandising. And so this record company was like, hey, just make a show. We got you. Just make something. And so Anno sets out to make something that is about not running away, something that will interrogate his own depression and will interrogate mecha anime. And in the years since he's made this show, it's taken on it's been one of those shows that's one of those pieces of media that's taken on such a huge reputation as being a classic and has such a vocal fan base that it's become incredibly polarizing. For some, it is overrated. It is the latest in a long line of mecha shows, but not necessarily something that subverts them. After all, mecha shows have, since Gundam at least, always been about the horror of war and the ways in which children are called upon to do things that they are not prepared for and that treats them as disposable soldiers instead of as individuals in their own rights. And also a lot of those takes say like all of the weird symbolism, it's shitty. It doesn't mean anything. It's all bullshit. It's lots of people looking for something where there isn't anything. The other side of that are people who see a work that reflects their own lives, reflects their history with depression, their issues with their parents, their journeys towards understanding their sexualities and their own identities. And often, sometimes when pushed to extreme, becomes a sort of scavenger hunt for some greater meaning, as the show's use of Judeo-Christian iconography, its use of Jungian archetypes, its use of existentialist and phenomenological philosophy, all is supposed to add up to something life-changing and life-affirming. I'm closer to that second camp. I am someone who watched this show when I was young, when I was 15, through bootlegs, through overpriced DVDs. And this was the age of spending $20 or $30 on a DVD with 2 to 4 episodes on it, downloading bad fan subs. I told you all how to watch some fan subs on the internet because this is not yet on Netflix. I had you all watch the first 2 episodes of the series.
I remember downloading episodes on LimeWire.
Absolutely.
Is what I shared. I've seen like the first episode of this.
Of course.
Probably around the same era.
Yep.
I think LimeWire is where I got my shit.
And like for me as a teen, I mean, what I told you last night, Rob, you and I briefly talked about this. We tried not to burn any cast, but like at this point, the point at which I saw Evangelion for the first time, I had seen some Gundam, especially Gundam Wing, which had become popular through Cartoon Network. I had seen, the BattleTech cartoon, plus had read a couple of those books. I'd seen Robotech, aka Macross, and then of course other robot stuff, Transformers, and some other similar things. And for me, they were cool toys. They were war machines, but they were mostly cool toys. Even though Gundam Wing is filled with anti-war messaging, mostly I was like, yeah, cool, cool, cool. But show me like the cool wings. Let me see Gundam Wing turn into a plane again. That shit was sick. And Evangelion was the first thing that made me realize I should hate giant robots and that mechs are scary and that there is something fascinating about the idea. And if you've listened to my other work, you know this, that we would ever decide to build giant war machines in our own image, right? There is something not inhuman about a tank. Why is it that instead we decided to build giant robots in these shows that look like us? Mm. What is happening there? And Evangelion was the first time I ever started to have those questions. And so for me, as a storyteller, as a critic, as a fan, this was a really important show. And it was really fun to revisit it. And I'm so curious about what you three thought about those two episodes I had you watch, which were the first two episodes. So just like before we get into my feelings about it, like what do you think?
I like the fact that it just jumps in.
Yeah.
Like I expected an enormous amount of – like this is both true of anime and of most media is like, all right, first 5 minutes, like set up that world for me with a narrator, man. Mm-hmm. Like let's do this. And instead, I was impressed by the fact that the world building is really subtle. It allows you to make sort of leaps and inferences about like what's happening. Like you're just told, oh, yeah, we call these angels. Why? Wait, what? Like,
yep.
It's been 15 years. Well, what happened 15 years ago? Like,
yeah.
You know, obviously questions that might, you know, like any good storytelling, like it'll go around to that. But I was impressed by the fact that it was more interested in like the immediacy, which reflected like the immediacy of the character Shinji as in the moment that he's thrust into. Like that's reflected in all sorts of the storytelling that happens, especially in that first episode where you were just tossed into a situation. And like, despite the fact that, you know, Evangelion is older at this point, like it still felt like refreshing and interesting. And I'm unfamiliar with most of the storytelling. I will say watching the intro, lots of internet memes made a lot more sense to me.
Yep.
Because all sorts of images and screen caps, I was like, oh, that's – I mean, I like knew it on some level that I know that like so much of like geek culture, internet geek culture is like rooted in anime and like a select series of anime like Dragon Ball and Evangelion. Like I knew that on some level. But like Shinji's father, I was like, oh, fuck, that's where that guy's from?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Like, I've seen giant text laid over that man's face all sorts of times. And so that's always fun when like you find a work that like suddenly fills in a lot of gaps mm-hmm. of like culture. But yeah, I really enjoyed the first two episodes like a lot because I got pulled into the world because of the lack of explanation. Like
yeah.
I found myself curious about filling in those gaps going forward.
What the fuck is an angel? Good question. What the fuck is the Human Instrumentality Project? Good question.
They just use terms. Like, they just throw terms out constantly, but they don't feel like gobbledygook. They feel
right.
like they're said with intent as though, like, look, man, we don't have fucking time to explain this to you. Like,
of course you know what an angel is. 15
yeah.
years ago, remember? Like, yeah.
But it doesn't usually – it's, like, usually, like, exposition is filled with – or dialogue is filled with so much, like, accidental or purposeful exposition in order to, like, sneak in world building for the audience member, even though the characters would never talk that way. And Evangelion doesn't seem to do any of that up front in a way that I found to really – that I really appreciated.
And that dovetails with something I really have enjoyed in these opening episodes. This is a world where things are happening and nobody's going to tell you why. They mm-hmm. have their reasons. Fuck you for asking. You know what I mean? Like this is a world of silent gods.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways. Like, and you know, part of it is the shattered relationship between Shinji and his father, who seems very much like just an indifferent Old Testament, you know, figure who, you know, sacrificing his children to complete his own design. But it also like the imagery is heavy-handed, but shit, I love heavy-handed imagery. There's
yeah.
this moment where the kid is being taken on this escalator into like the heart of
it's
the
like
mech
a,
facility.
Yeah, it's like a car escalator.
Yep.
And people are talking. No. This is when he's on the personal escalator.
Oh, gotcha.
And so people are talking over his head, literally talking over his head about what they're up to. And he's just like downcast eyes. And in the background, stretching out of
the
background.
Oh, it's so good!
Is this giant like hand in a claw grip. Reaching out for him, and he's framed against it briefly, and,
right.
then, and then it's passed. And it's such a great moment, and
they don't talk about it. It's not Shinji doesn't turn. So part of the reason why you don't get that exposition is because Shinji, who is like deep in his feelings, is not asking anybody anything. I promise you, there are exposition dumps in Evangelion eventually, and you get them through what feel like natural channels. Or at least I remember. It's been 6 or 7 years since I watched this whole
but
show.
But the fact that it's not happening in the first two
is
episodes,
important.
which
yeah.
is contrary to, especially this is probably because so much like modern narrative. does all of that up front of, like, you know the classic Star Wars scroll, yeah. Or something like that. Like, you get all of that in a way that Evangelion, at least in the first two episodes, isn't doing. So it's like, yeah, of course that's going to happen eventually, but at least up front, like, it is striking and telling that it's not doing that, at least in the first two episodes.
A couple of things immediately came to mind. First, it was beautiful. I loved the first shots. The first few shots where it's just ambient noise, yeah. And you see the angel kind of walking in. It's before any of the war machines are, like, actually firing on it, but they're all lined up. You just hear, like, seagulls flying by in the water.
I was like, cicadas and...
Yeah, cicadas. Really strong cicada noises. Oh, yeah. And it was
welcome
just like
anime. They're everywhere.
It's summer. Yeah. Uh-huh. Like, it was very, very evocative. So I thought that was really rad. And also, like, similar to you, Patrick, a lot of things started to make sense. A lot of friends' screen names started to make sense.
Oh, really?
A whole lot of, like, oh, that's where this is from.
That's really funny.
As well. Which is very funny to me because I've always been like, what's that from? And they were like, oh, have you seen this thing? Also, I had this preconceived notion forever. Because, you know, through osmosis, that it was actually angels. Like, angels from heaven and Bibles. And I'm not saying it's not that, but...
Have you ever read about what angels actually look like in Christian...
They're supposed to be pretty terrifying.
They're actually supposed to be pretty terrifying. Yeah. And so, like, that's one of the things that's super fascinating about the way these angels are is, like, oh, these things are inhuman. Or if they have humanoid figures, they are not... like, idealized the way Renaissance painting angels are.
They don't have big white fluffy feathers. They're actually, like, very grotesque looking from what I remember. Right. So I was like, oh, that's what the angels are. Because I knew there were angels in this. Because at one point a friend was like, well, the plot is angels come to Earth. And then they said a bunch of other things that I could not tell you. I don't remember it in the slightest. But I was like, oh, angels came to Earth. Okay, it's religious. It's a Eastern take on Western religion. That's what it is. Okay.
Which you could buy because there's lots. I mean, go back and look at Xenogears. Like, there are all sorts of instances of Japanese stories, like, grafting Christian iconography and stories into it. So I'm with you. Like, I could definitely see why you would buy that.
Yeah.
Totally. Well, so for me, the thing that – the takeaway that's, like, the through line for all of you, and it's one for me – going back to watch this was, I mean, you're not going to know in the first two episodes if it speaks to you on that deeper level, on that, like, hey, this says something to me about my depression or my sexuality or my identity or about politics or about the history of the world or philosophy. Like, who knows in two episodes? But what I can say confidently in revisiting it is that as a work of craft, as a show, it's so much better than I even remember it. Because when I think about Ava, I think about some key sequences. There's a sequence later on in the series in which two pilots need to sync up their movements and they, like, listen to music together. It's like the idea of drift in Pacific Rim. Like, Pacific Rim doesn't happen without Ava, to be clear. And the idea of, like, synced up drift minds in Pacific Rim is lifted from that episode of Ava where they have to, like, match their – it's like, okay, I remember the robots dancing, basically. Okay, I remember, you know, this encounter between Gendo and Shinji. What I didn't remember was just the quiet moments that end up being really – well made, and I mean that in the most superlative way I can. There is beautiful shot composition, like you said, Danielle, throughout the entire first episode. There's a massive robotic arm that you talked about, Rob. The reveal of the mega city under the ground, and it's just, like, weird pyramid.
Oh, that's amazing.
Wide shots of the, like, the city that's been taken by the sea as the angel walks towards it. The moment at the end of episode two where Shinji sees the Ava unit's true face in the reflection of the skyscraper. These things are just, like, really well composed. But there's also, like, beyond those big picture things that are saying something about ecology or whatever, it's just character moment stuff that's communicated the way good visual storytelling is communicated. There's that scene, like, episode two has two moments of this that I want to call out. One is there's the scene in which Shinji and Misato are leaving the hospital. Shinji's been there since the encounter with the angel, and the door opens, the elevator door opens, and Gendo is inside, and Shinji can't look at his father, looks away, the door closes. And, like, on paper, that's already, like, okay, yeah, that's a good character moment to understand that Shinji has this fear of his father. They're estranged. They have, like, where is the mother in this? Blah, 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 blah. Really interesting stuff. But on the screen, it's even stronger because it's mostly communicated through this long, bright shot looking upward at them. You see, like, their bodies towering, looking at each other, which in a show about giant robots robots, anytime that you're making people look tall is important. And you're looking up at the ceiling, and on Gendo's side, it is a super bright white fluorescent light, which also the whole hospital is just like bathed in fluorescent light and desaturated. And it's like it looks so good and bad at the same time, you know. And on the other side, on the side where Misato and Shinji are, it's kind of dappled and blue-black, and like there aren't the grid kind of fades away and it's dark, and like the door closes and you could get them divided. And like dividing characters on a screen by way of physical interaction or physical, like a physical object, is like a classic school, like film school technique. It's film 101. Hey, if there's a division between these characters, draw a fucking line literally on the screen. This happens at the end of The Graduate. It's like a very popular scene that includes this, right? It's like a classic thing. And then later in that same episode, Shinji has to walk into Masato's apartment, into his new home, and they frame it a similar way at his feet, showing him break the threshold, showing him wait and then break the threshold. And that's just like good 101 storytelling that's quiet. And there's another really quick one I'm going to do very quickly, which is there's a sequence after that sequence. They leave the hospital. He gets into the car and they're going to drive to Masato's place. Masato is going to become his like foster parent, effectively, almost like a big sister figure for him. As they're driving through this tunnel, she's basically saying, oh, we got to have a party. And he's like, why do we need to have a party? Because I'm a depressed emo teen. Yeah. And she's like, to celebrate, you know, we're roommates now. And he like turns to look at her. And you could end the scene there. You could show the car drive out the tunnel. And instead, you hear the sound of a truck approaching. And it just goes like, and there suddenly is light behind her and it silhouettes her. And that's the shot that Shinji sees. And this is why the show seems like it probably holds up for me, is that's one of those things you don't even realize unless you're watching with a very engaged critical eye, but which has an effect on you as the viewer. It produces in you a sense of anxiety, a sense of sound being disruptive. It puts you in Shinji's place where what you want is quiet and suddenly that's removed from the sequence. And so what you end up with is a feeling about Shinji, even though the show doesn't come out and say in that moment, and Shinji felt awkward about that car ride, you get that impression. And the show is just very good at those sorts of storytelling techniques. And that was really impressive for me to revisit it. And I didn't expect any of that stuff. I remembered the plot dumps. I remembered the fight. And the fights are cool also, to be fair.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I loved, like, things that I really enjoyed as well as that second episode, as Shinji begins paying the cost for having piloted this war machine, and like, right away, like, the cool relationship between pilot and machine. Like, we were talking a little bit about this last night. There's this tagline that Pacific Rim never delivered on, but always like advertised itself with, which was to fight monsters, we created monsters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's nothing monstrous about the Jaeger program in that movie. Like, they're big fucking robots piloted by, you know, cool national stereotypes.
They're Power Rangers.
Yes.
Like Pacific Rim trafficked in anime mecha and kaiju.
Yep.
But actually, it was just Power Rangers, which I loved me some Power Rangers.
In
like,
this
Tommy, the Green Ranger, like, please, right. Like, right. Give me that.
I mean, so that is the
ooh, you're a bad boy.
We all like Tommy. Come on. Tommy was great, right? No? Did we not all Tommy
stands? Tommy was good.
Tommy
was good.
So Tommy you watched, you didn't see
I was watching Xena at the
that's
time.
That's fair. That's I'm fair. Sorry. Tommy is the... Yeah, anyway. So the thing I just want to briefly call out, Rob, that you know, and both of you in with regard to Pacific Rim, is that Pacific Rim is clearly in this heritage. It's a show about giant – or a movie about giant mechs fighting against kaiju. But that's also the history of giant mechs. Mechs begin, you know, in – I don't want to get like super deep into the history, but like the first mecha shows – are super robot shows. They're called super robots because they're super powerful robots. And they're fighting aliens and they're fighting kaiju. And they're emerging out of the same moment that shows like Ultraman are gaining popularity. And eventually the Sentai shows, in which sometimes it is Power Rangers and there are literally giant mechs fighting giant kaiju, right? That stuff happens for years. It happens through the 70s or through the 60s and the 70s, really. I mean, even further back, there were like straight up puppet shows with giant robots and stuff in the early to mid 20th century that like have piloted giant robots in them. But they're always this kind of just like larger than life, separated from mundane, from the kind of weight of mundanity, separated from mechanics. Like maybe you have someone who has a remote control to pilot something, but mostly it doesn't matter how they're controlling it. Mostly they're just big robot suits. And And then when Gundam hits in 1979, it shifts to be a real war story. They start calling these real robot shows to contrast with super robot shows. Mm. They're not real in the sense that they're hard science fiction in the literary sense, but in comparison to shows like Mazinger Z, they are kind of hard science fiction. They explain why you might want to use giant robots because of weird particle effects and stuff, instead of it just being like, yeah, of course you use the big super robot. Why wouldn't you? And real robots end up dominating the scene for another decade or two. When Eva comes out, there's this weird moment in which super robots are on the decline, but real robots haven't had a real big breakout in a bit. And what Eva ends up doing is sort of synthesizing these feelings. It returns to the super robot model of this isn't like Vietnam but with giant mechs. This is about alien invaders and singular powerful machines who can give you superhuman powers. But it's all grounded in the costs of war, in the psychological costs of being a human, period, and kind of brings in the terrified young pilot from Gundam. Shinji is not unique in the sense that he doesn't want to fight. That is Amuro Ray, the hero from the first Gundam show, who is again a teenage boy whose father built the first Gundam. Like, that is literally show of Gundam, is Amuro Ray's father, Tamura Ray, built Gundam, and he, because of a twist of fate, he has to stumble into it to save the day and protect people, and he doesn't want to do it because he's a teenage boy. That stuff is literally that. So there isn't a subversion in that sense. What it is it decides that the focal point of the show should be that terror, and that you can make an entire show in the super robot space that almost stretches those things out, because when you do have a singular machine, a singular living god, instead of it being a mass-produced, you know, tank, basically, all of those feelings become that much more intense and that much more everything feels more precarious, right? Because if this one machine breaks, you're fucked, which is kind of where the show kind of starts. It's like, okay, this is our last-ditch chance. There's that great line where basically Masato is like, are we really going to – can we just do this? And Gendo is like, of course. Unless we defeat the angels, we have no future. People don't matter. It doesn't matter what an individual does. It's just throw them to the fucking dogs, throw them into the gears, and hope for the best.
Well, and the fact this machine is like, there's something unholy about it.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like,
oh, yeah.
The fact that, so contrast this with like, well, Battletech certainly traffics in this. Escaflowne, like, is a decent example of like, if you're a good enough pilot and you like are at peace enough with yourself and you really know thyself, you'll be the best. You will unlock the full power of the Escaflowne
and Gracie robot style and jiu-jitsu.
I was just going to say, like, if you have a black belt in Brazilian
burgers,
jiu-jitsu,
mechs, and fighting in the age of loneliness, you know?
Yes.
But what I like here is from the first, like, there's sort of a watchful, alive sense to the robot before he ever even pilots it. Like, mm-hmm. the fact that, like, this thing is waiting for him and it needs him, not necessarily to control it or pilot him. It just needs him to function, to fulfill its role. And there's something deeply creepy about the way that relationship is framed from the beginning. And I do love in that second episode, the way the cost of that relationship borne out through Shinji's obvious like PTSD that everyone's just ignoring.
Yeah.
And like, I love the little details of like, he keeps having these like brief, like really scary, like quick flashes of things like that have happened or that he saw. And they're like literally just like 2-3 frames long.
Yeah.
And then you're snapped back to whatever his present is. And he's, you know, just trying to get accustomed to these new surroundings, but the thoughts keep breaking through.
Please just imagine 15-year-old Austin with a remote control hitting pause as those little flips happen, trying to get each still shot to see, okay, what's he thinking about? What's happening? What is the secret to unlock here? Which is not the way to watch the show, honestly.
Yeah. And yet I did it. Uh-huh. I was reading documents. I was like, ooh, what's this say?
Yeah. Well, I think go ahead, Patrick, please.
Oh, no, I'll follow up after.
Very quick thing, which is just to Rob's point about the Eva Unit 1 needing Shinji. One of the things that's interesting there too in the history of mechs is that often you have the teenage pilot who's like, oh, I'm the one who could do it the best. And so that's why you got to put Amuro in the Gundam, because Amuro's piloted the Gundam. He's very smart. It ends up that he's a new type, which is a special – it's like a Jedi sort of, not really. He's like force sensitive sort of kind of. And so he's like really good at machines. He does – like Donatello, Amuro Ray does machines. And so there is like a degree to which – there's like, oh, the special individual. Shinji is also the special individual. They say like there's a 0.00001% chance that this is going to work. But he's not special in that he's good at piloting yeah. it. He's special that he is literally the key you put in the slot to make it do anything. And that is such a dreadful – I mean, so that is part of the commentary about this show is that it goes really dark places. It does want to inquire about Shinji's sexuality. It does want to inquire about what it means to have a broken relationship with your family. It does want to inquire about the way women are used and discarded. It does all of that stuff. And then the response ends up being really, really rough to get into. Like, there are death threats sent to this team because of how the show ends. Wow. And then they follow up with a movie series that rewrites the ending of the series. And it does it, and it's like
it's a two-part movie series.
It's a
right?
three-part movie. I'm pretty sure End of Eva. It's been years since I've watched End of Eva, but like the death threats show up on screen. Like the End of Eva is like a big fuck you to parts of the fandom that were aggressive and terrible. And also, this is a story about depression, and it's written by someone who's working through his depression. And often it goes to places that are. Not just problematic in the sense that they engage with content that you kind of feel upset by or that you feel like has a bad ideology behind it, but are also just hard to deal with, cynical, nihilistic, and that can put people off of the show in a major way, and I get that. Patrick, you had a point earlier that I stepped on.
That's okay. Like one, your pitch as a nihilist, the nihilistic pitch is actually – that works for me. Like it's 2018. Yeah, dude. Like let's
do
this.
Dude, there is shit I want to talk about in this series that you don't know yet that is wild.
So part of what was the hook, and I have two quick points. One is that watching the intro to the show, like the introduction of the angel – it reminds me a lot of like before kaiju became kaiju, in which it became like giant rubbery creatures just bashing the shit out of each other. Like go watch the original Godzilla. Like go watch Gojira. Like it is there's a great Criterion Collection edition of it. It is still, despite you know the progress of digital effects or even practical effects, like a very effective film. And it there's a sense of awe to like creatures that are and things that are beyond us, things that do come across to us as gods, and we are just small little things that have no impact. And like what I enjoyed about the intro was we got back to some of my. I mean, I enjoy the goofy you know aspects of kaiju, but like my favorites are like the original Godzilla, the elements of the rebooted Godzilla that tried to get back to that original sense of like no, like this is like. Something beyond our understanding that is to be feared and both to look at in awe. And mm-hmm. So I think it really nails that part of early sort of like kaiju features that were actually about sort of respecting these giant, unimaginable things, even as much as they threatened us. And two, this show has a very weird sexual energy.
Yeah, dog. Mm. You ain't seen shit yet. It's a lot.
I bet. So like there were like two shots in particular that stood out to me. One was when they're in the car and the camera is positioned down in her crotch. And I expected, like, oh, right, okay, so this is going to be the thing, like, sexy anime lady, like, he's going to, like, start, like, trying to, like, look over at her. And, like, this is going to be the moment where, like, the reason it's angled down by her crotch is, like, he's going to go, like, look over her and, like, start sweating. You know, like, he's attracted to her and doesn't know how to deal with it. And then the second one was, like, when they're, one... deep respect for the amount of malt liquor this woman can put down. Yo. Like, this reminded me a lot of early days with me drinking with my wife where we would just get like a 30 pack and have way too many of them and they'd all stack up on a table. So like, enjoyed that part. Mm-hmm. But two, there's just like the shot of her ass out of nowhere. That just positions right behind her. But what's weird about both of them, and again, maybe this is more clear, and the reason I call it weird sexual energy is because the shots don't feel especially sexualized. They just, I mean, they are, but they aren't like, leering in the way I don't know, like
the
again, like
camera angles But not right. necessarily.
Well,
because
the guy, like Shinji doesn't comment on it, right? Because there's the A, which is the creep shot angle, and then there's usually the B, which is character reacting to that creep shot angle, and Shinji does not react in either scene. And so like there's this dynamic that's being set up in which it's like, oh, like you know, older woman, younger boy, but like you know, eventually like they're gonna have sex, like or it's gonna get weird, and. I don't know. Like, again, like, Austin, you're alluding to a lot.
There is a lot.
Where, stuff so, might, where this would go. But, like, I just, the first two episodes set up a very strange sexual energy that is both different than what I expect from, like, the anime trope of how they would set up, like, this dynamic. And I just have no idea where it goes from here because I don't even know what the show is communicating with the...
With what it's there now.
The shot frameworks are so specific that I find myself confused in an interesting way. I just don't know what to take away from it, from what I've seen so far.
I was so confused by the postcard at the very beginning, too. I was like, is she like a honeypot?
Yeah, that's how it comes across.
Is that what's going on here?
Yeah.
And I clearly just confused about what was going on there.
So there's like two answers. One, I think that whole sequence when they go back to Misato's place and they reveal Pen Pen, the penguin, the fucking rad ass rude penguin. Hey,
picking up the can is a great visual gag.
The fucking raddest fucking roommate.
I know. I want Pen Pen as a roommate too. The reveal, yeah, the mat, there's like, this is a box of toothpicks underneath the malt liquor can to not reveal Shinji's dick is like, okay, wow, lots happening here. And also, I don't know if any of you watch the next time on that happens after the end credits, which are Fly Me to the Moon, by the way, and great. But in both of the end credits, Misato is the narrator, and she's like, and there'll be fan service referring to her TNA, right? Her ass up on the screen.
Yeah.
And this is one of those like very contested issues in the series' fandom, partially because the show absolutely objectifies women in the ways that anime often does, and partially because the show objectifies women in the narrative in important ways that are hard to – it is hard to know if it is a successful satire or if it's just doing the thing anime does sometimes. And by that I mean this is a contested field. Eva released in 1995. It has been, you know – years, 20 plus years of debate around this stuff. This is part of why there's so much energy around this Netflix re-release. It's like, we're going to fucking live through this discourse, aren't we? This is going to – the discourse is fucking coming. Like, how long until Eva is too problematic when in fact it is problematic? But it's also this look at things like depression and then specifically – this points to the Misato stuff. There are two other characters. You saw Rei a little bit, the blue-haired girl who is like crawling out of her fucking stretcher to try to get back into a robot at one point. And then another young woman named Asuka who are both objects of sexual interest for Shinji but also Shinji's – sexuality and his queerness end up being a central factor in the later half of the show. Hmm. Him struggling with the fact that he has attraction to other men.
Hmm. On top spoilers.
Yeah, it's important. It's worth knowing this. Okay. And it's not worth knowing it because it isn't
– I'm just saying because we're – okay, yeah. Yeah, okay. We made some promise that
– You're already committed to this, huh, Patrick?
Patrick is
yeah,
here.
I am. I'm in.
I'm in too.
Doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah. In the spring, we're going to do
when it hits.
Be good and rewatch it. And we're going to just watch this whole series. I'm fucking in. Let's do this.
Let's do it. I'm here.
This is
for
turning
it.
Into my Dragon Ball Z.
Hell
giant
yes.
bomb. Like,
yeah.
Let's
Hell
watch
yes.
Neon Genesis Evangelion. I'm in.
Hell yeah. Finally. Finally.
We did it.
Waypoint's been worth it. It's finally
Look,
come together.
It's all been worth it.
Austin, I got you to seriously sit and critique 4 fucking Purge movies. The least I can do. The least I can do.
Those movies are
all right.
All said.
I'll have the same response to this show, probably.
Probably. You know, there are some things that everyone at this table are going to have some fucking thoughts about. I'm excited.
Good.
And there's another thing here, which is that Eva is also in the middle of a sort of renaissance in a sense. We're in the middle of the release of 4 different Ava movies, is that right? Yeah, four.
It turned what?
Four has not come out yet. So
wait, I thought the last one was just a big fuck you to fans and it's done.
That was end of Ava. Starting in 2007, there have been a series of things called Rebuild of Evangelion, aka Evangelion, the new theatrical edition, which have been retellings, movie-based retellings of the show with some major differences. I haven't seen these at all. I never got around to them because I'm waiting for them all to be done. And three of them are out. 2001 came out in 2007, one came out in 2009, one came out in 2012. The last one is due out in 2020.
Oh, important. So connected to that, the reason that last one has been delayed is because the last Japanese Godzilla film was directed and written by the Evangelion guy, Anno.
Yeah.
And that film I haven't seen it yet. Now this is going to be an excuse to finally go sit and watch it because I can't watch Evangelion until the spring. Right. And the new one is essentially like him trying to find to recontextualize the original Godzilla film.
Right.
To find a way to be scared and mortified of Godzilla as a creature and in a political context in the same way that the original Godzilla dealt with our fears of nuclear annihilation. So these movies take forever, but I remember hearing about those because people were kind of pissed that he was working on a Godzilla film because it was going to delay any work.
That's extremely funny.
That's amazing.
I haven't seen that. I really want to see that too. We should watch that between now and then.
There's one.
That's an easy one to add to the, the Be Good and Rewatch It list. Mm-hmm. There's so much more to talk about. Even just in terms of sexuality stuff with Gendo, his father trying to, push on Shinji what a man is. Like that stuff, it does go there. And the thing that my big takeaway from this revisit of it has given me is that if it works in the end, and again, we were going to have to rewatch it to see if it works for us and if all of its contradictions and its nihilism and everything else do add up to something really special. I suspect it will for me, but I suspect it will because of these little moments, not because of the symbology and not the fan service and not the mech fights, though those are really cool. Like that mech fight is dope. That monster is cool. It does feel strange and different. It does not just feel like this, like a kaiju in the very mass produced, it's a big monster, rubbery monster sense. But I think it's those little moments. It's those quiet character moments. It's the way the shot composition happens. It's the music. The music in the show is fantastic all the way through. And it is the way it is knowledgeable about its place and time in history. That I guess for me, the very last thing is, and Rob, you and I again briefly talked about this, is when Unit 1 is finally revealed on screen, not just a hand in the distance, not just a head poking out of weird green water. It emerges and they begin to do work on it because they have to prep it for launch. And this is a sacrosanct type of sequence in mecha anime culture. The reveal of the machine. This is what the series is based on. Run out and buy the model kit. Run out and buy the toy. Quickly go buy the game. This is the hero. And it plays the triumphant swell. It has the orchestral music come in as if we were showing you your god is here. But it's like this sickly purple green monster, and it has weird ridges where there should not be any, and it is spiked where it should be smooth, and it has a mouth. Why does my giant robot have a mouth? What's going on there? And that is like it is sick in a really powerful way, right? It's like Gundam was always already Evangelion, right? The Gundam is already a sick monster. But because there is a toy deal, you got to make it look good. That's not a joke. Gundam was remodeled over and over again until it looked like a good toy. And the creators of that show knew what the fuck it was. That is a show about fuck off with war. Protect the people you love, but don't be a warmonger. These machines make us the worst versions of ourselves. Truly, we should retreat until we are swans in nature. But the show has to put on the show. And Evangelion, from the jump, is not only not putting on the show, it is not interested in it. And
or it's perverting the show.
100%. Mm-hmm. Or it's revealing the perversion that was always there.
Yeah.
Not to get too Zizekian about it, but I'm not going to do my Zizek. Nope. I would cover Danielle and spit, but imagine
with Zizek. I need a shower.
Yes, 100%. I'm sure Zizek fucking loves Ava, actually. Anyway, that's Evangelion. We'll return to it in a few months' time whenever Netflix deigns to grace us with its presence. Hopefully that Cowboy Bebop show is out by then, too, because I'm sure I'll have thoughts on that.
Don't be whammy. Oh,
Also, there's a live-action Korean version of Jinro. I need people to tell me whether that's good or not. Doesn't look good.
While seems we're in to our think anime.
Jinro is neon cyberpunk. So that seems like the wrong thing to take away from that. But anyway, if people have seen the live-action Jinro, let me know. Anyway, that will do it for this week's Waypoints. Our thanks to Tumelo for the track Slide Asleep off the album After Midnight. You can find that at tumelomakes.bandcamp.com. You can keep up with all of us at waypoint.vice.com. I'm Rob Zachney. You can find me on Twitter, at Rob Zachney. Patrick, where can people find you?
At Patrick Klepek.
Danielle.
Practicing MMA at Danielle Ori.
Austin.
Austin_Walker, and I'm just going to plug my fucking thing. If you think listening to me talk about giant robots is cool, you should listen to Friends at the Table's second season, Counterweight. It is all about this shit. It is literally me trying to work through my feelings about giant robots. Look it up.
Nice.
All right. Well, we hope you've enjoyed the break. We'll be back again with Waypoint Radio later this week. We hope you'll join us again. But until then, do not give in to astonishment.
All right.
Good show.
Good. Okay, so Austin, hold on though.
Yeah.
When Shinji sees the reflection from the mech's head.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I'm wrong. That mech's head is on the fucking ground.
No, the armor has fallen off of the head, revealing an organic interior. It has an eyeball. It has flesh.
It regrows.
It regrows. But yeah, no. He's not seeing the head on the ground. He's seeing it's as if the knight's helmet has fallen off to reveal, in fact, it is not a big robot. It is a big creature, and he has been inserted into it.
Hell yeah.
Lest we become them. It means it. So just fucking wait.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Wait, on Kato. My guess
he
is
ran out to get water.
Oh, did he also?
It's just water. Yeah, okay. I think so. I don't think he's going to be.
It's a great song.
I didn't even know I was doing it.
It's so good.
You Vernon Cast
he
over
was,
here.
He was whistling Cruel Angel's Thesis.
Oh, good.
I've heard that song exactly twice in my life, and it's lodged
in really?
My head.
You've heard
Dude, I have never seen any Evangelion.
But you've never seen, like, it's never been, like, sent to
no
you.
No AMVs?
No AMVs, no. Weird.